Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello, yes, it's the Lost in Science Summer Series. While the continent swelters through a heat wave, we're taking it easy with a look back on some of our favourite stories from the past year. Of course, there are just too many to do them all justice, so in the spirit of science, I can assign you some homework. If you're into politics, but maybe you want a break from the immediate catastrophes, I can recommend our episode from the 11th September, in which I interviewed climate scientist Michael E. Mann and vaccinologist Peter Hotez about their new book, Science Under Siege, How to Fight the Five Most Powerful Forces That Threaten Our World. If you want something lighter, though, always fun, is our episode on the annual Ig Nobel Prizes for Research that makes you laugh and then makes you think. That one went to air on the 9th of October 2025, if you'd like to hunt it down. For this episode, though, I am tackling a couple of brain-related controversies. First up, if you've been reading that everyone these days is getting diagnosed and medicated for ADHD, well, I pull apart those claims and find it's not as extreme as it looks. And then Claire and Stu discuss a new large study about the effect of water fluoridation on cognition and IQ. Spoiler, there was no effect. But look, I recommend listening to it anyway, so put your feet up, sip an icy drink, and on with the show. Okay, yes, you're listening to Lost in Science, and I am talking about the ongoing sort of controversy probably most people are aware of about ADHD, and in particular some of the recent reporting that's happened about that. Claire, have you given any thought to this issue?
You know what? I haven't really given it too much thought, Chris. So please, lay it on me.
Well, it's something that I think has come up with a lot of people, that it's being seen on social media, it's being talked about in various media sources, and that sort of thing. It's been a scientific issue for several years now, of like, is everyone getting diagnosed with ADHD, particularly our children being overdiagnosed with it, etc., etc. But yeah, it has kind of come now to more attention because it's not going away, this controversy. And now you've got, you know, newspapers like the New York Times, the Grey Lady, the paper of record, is reporting on this. And I'm referring to
What are they reporting?
Well, this is
that it's being overdiagnosed.
So this is an article that was published recently by writer Paul Tough. And it's called "Have We Been Thinking About ADHD All Wrong?" Let's ignore Betteridge's Law of Headlines here, but that is the question that they raised. And the tagline gives us a good idea of the slant of the article. So basically, it says, "With diagnoses at a record high, some experts have begun to question our assumptions about the condition and how to treat it." And the assumptions he lays out as that ADHD is a medical disorder that demands a medical solution, that it is caused by inherent deficits in children's brains, and that the medications we give them repair those deficits. There's a bit to unpack there, but essentially it is about, is it being overdiagnosed, and are we just basically giving people medicines unnecessarily, essentially the main thing. So look, let's try and dig into this. And I should say, there is genuine controversy here, on this issue, and I'm not going to solve all these issues. This article apparently took a year to put together, with all the resources of the New York Times. And I'm just me. So
I cannot compete with that. I'm just examining some of the claims in this and saying, put in the context of what we know about the research and where they get to in this kind of discussion, because this is emblematic of the kind of concerns that people have. All right, but let's start. First of all, ADHD, what is it? It stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. It's what it says written on the tin, but it manifests in two main ways. It's either hyperactivity and impulsivity, this kind of, you know, hyperactive movement sort of thing, or inattentiveness is the other way it can manifest, be difficulty paying attention to things, or a combination of both. They call it a hybrid type of ADHD. And yes, diagnoses have been rising. And it's pretty easy to see that. So in the early 1990s, the figures, I'm going to look at US figures here because this is a US article, and it's nice to have like a baseline of a consistent country, even though people, when they talk about this, they tend to look at a lot of different countries, and it makes sense to look at Australia as well. But here in the US in the early 1990s, it affected about 3% of children. And now the rate is up to about 7% of the population, which doesn't sound like a huge big increase, but bear in mind that in the 1990s, it was only children. It was defined as a childhood disease. Adults were seen to grow out of it. You couldn't have it as an adult. And it was primarily also diagnosed in boys, whereas now we're seeing, you know, girls and women being diagnosed with ADHD. So you're expanding it from children to adults, and from just boys mostly to now girls and women. So when we say it's increased from 3% to 7%, we're also talking a much broader kind of base. If you drill down to the actual kind of comparable figures, the CDC data for 2024 puts it around 11.5% of children overall having the condition. And again, still more in boys, with, if you look at 17-year-old boys, up to 23% of them have been diagnosed with ADHD at some point. So, yeah, that does sound like a very large number.
It does, yeah.
But I guess the trouble there when we're looking at this, trying to be all scientific about this, is it too much? I mean, how would we know? Like, what is the real number? You look at that and you go, well, that does sound like a lot, but what is the real number? And
yeah, and how do you find that real
exactly
number?
You have to presumably track the research and track the rates of it. And, you know, you're either going to be saying that people are being incorrectly diagnosed or that they are uncovering a condition that is there. I mean, we're still talking about, we're saying 23%, that's still, you know, less than a quarter. So it's still a minority of the population. What should it be? And so it is a tricky, it is a tricky thing.
Yeah. And is it consistent across different countries?
Look, it does vary. They're seeing rises in all countries. And that's a fair question. And even in the US, you see big variations across different states, which kind of is an indication that there may be something going on in the diagnostic practices as well, the fact that it's more in some places than in others. But, you know, it is also a subjective diagnosis, I suppose. Like, the way it is diagnosed is essentially, do people fill these certain criteria? Does it impair their functioning, their life? Does it affect their life, their schoolwork, or, you know, work? So do they have an impairment is the question that has to be decided. And causing it, is it something that modern life, the way that modern life is changing, is creating issues that now people are facing more issues than they used to in the past? It's hard to know what is really going on. But, you know, I guess the other thing is that, you know, we are seeing the biggest rise in adults who only recently have been able to have ADHD at all. And people there are seeking out a diagnosis, and presumably they're seeking out a diagnosis because they believe they have a problem. You know, there is something there that is they're facing, they're an issue they're facing. So it, you know, there is debate about the cause and what is the real number, but there is a real phenomenon that's going on here that people are seeking treatment for. Because part of the problem is we also don't really understand what's going on in the brain. So the article in question does point this out. They also kind of downplay the differences. There have been differences found in various kind of analysis of brain in brain scans, in brain wave activity, in you know, the size of various functional areas. So there are differences between ADHD and non-ADHD brains, but the size and significance of those differences is still uncertain, really. So it is hard to say, but we can see differences. How significant those differences are is not certain. It's a tricky one because, the brain is where all our thought and behavior takes place anyway. So if someone is acting different to someone else, then if you look hard enough at their brain, you will see a difference because kind of almost by definition, there's going to be something going on differently in their brain. But whether there's something in the structure of the brain that's causing the problem or it's responding to someone else is really hard to tell. And it's really hard to fact check kind of an article like this because it's not a scientific article. It's a news article. It's in the New York Times magazine. And, you know, articles like this, they rely on storytelling. So they have a practice. They do things like they look at individual studies. Often the smaller and more dramatic studies are the best stories, but not necessarily the best science. And so it's very easy to say, oh, they're cherry picking things to give the message that they're looking for and this kind of thing. I've also noticed with a lot of these, this kind of reporting, they like to go to the original source for things. So they will go, okay, so, people are giving stimulants for ADHD. Who was the first person to do that and what science did they base that on? And they go, well, if there's a flaw in that study, then that shows the whole thing is wrong. And that's not how science works. Obviously, you know, studies build on the data, certainly they build on an initial idea, but you know, you confirm or disconfirm something based on new findings. You don't say, okay, everything relies on this one foundational study. You don't hang your hat entirely on that. And that's a particular case when we talk at this issue around stimulant use, which is kind of the biggest issue they talk about. Now, I don't have time to go into all of that either, but basically this article paints a picture that the stimulants are ineffective, but they are being pushed essentially by clinicians and the ADHD community. And that, you know, the people think that there's ADHD is caused by a deficiency in brain chemistry and that stimulants are correcting that deficiency. And again, I don't think anyone really seriously believes that that's the case because, you know, as I said, we don't really know what causes ADHD. And just because the medication works for a condition doesn't mean it's correcting a deficiency. Mm-hmm. Like, to give an example, headaches are not caused by a paracetamol deficiency. You know,
right.
You're taking medication that has a physiological effect. It doesn't mean that it is, yeah, you needed that medication to get by. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Having said that, they're not entirely wrong. I did look into science. We would want to get to that. There are a few large reviews on this topic. I like to go to the Cochrane Collaboration. It's always the gold standard of systematic reviews and meta-analysis. And they've got separate reviews for, say, for children or for adults. They generally find that these medications give an improvement in ADHD symptoms, but there's little effect on work or school performance. And of course, there are adverse effects that come with these medications as well. And the evidence is usually of very low quality. And one of their reasons for that being low quality evidence apparently is it's hard to do placebo trials because people can tell if they're taking a stimulant medication.
That's fair enough as
yeah,
well. Isn't
yeah.
It?
So there's not great, even though this is such a big thing, there's not actually great scientific evidence for it. And the evidence is not as strong as you'd imagine for something like this. But it still is not the disaster that is often sort of painted as. Just as an aside, though, I found it interesting that the New York Times article doesn't seem to talk about the potential role of the drug companies, who are the ones presumably profiting from the
interesting
medications. They said put the blame on the clinicians, saying the clinicians are just trying to drug their patients and not saying, oh, who's actually making money out of this? I don't know what's... It's just a comment, just an observation. I don't know. I'm not accusing them. But so what they really do get it wrong is they kind of imply that, as I said, clinicians are pushing this, but no one is really saying that stimulants are the only line of treatment, or even the first line of treatment, particularly for children. I had a look at the current Australian clinical guidelines. They talk primarily a lot about the non-pharmacological treatments, and they have a whole set of recommendations about how to come off medication when people feel like they don't want it anymore. It's like a discussion together, you know, what are they trying to achieve? And it's not all about you must keep taking these drugs. It's not all about the drugs, essentially. There's a whole lot of other things that people do as well. And when you get to the end of the New York Times article, that's kind of the point that they arrive at. They say that, you know, medication has a place for controlling symptoms, but ultimately people need to be able to live lives that make the most of their strengths, doesn't cause them difficulties, which is essentially what you hear coming out of things like the neurodiversity movement, the social model of disability. It's all about, you know, how do we make the most of people's strengths and things, not just drugging them into submission. But yeah, I guess what's interesting is that you have something like this that is voicing these concerns that a lot of people voice. The reality in the science is not as alarming as the concerns are, but yeah, ultimately there's a lot of agreement, just a lot of panic out there as well.
Congratulations on your discovery, which may well prove to be among the most significant in the history of science.
I cannot accept half-baked theories that sell newspapers. I'm a scientist.
Who are you? Who are so wise in the ways of science?
A most distinguished scientist whose name we know, even in the wild of Transylvania.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you are listening to Lost in Science.
So, Stu, everywhere you look or hear these days, it seems like decades-old public health initiatives that have time and time again been proven to be safe and cost-effective and reliable and equitable, they seem to be under attack. And one of these initiatives that's under attack most recently in the US by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is the addition of fluoride into drinking water.
Yeah.
Now, unsurprisingly, RFK, he's making moves to stop the Center for Disease Control from recommending fluoride in the water, and already the state of Utah has banned fluoride in water altogether. So some pretty serious things, and some public health initiatives being stopped in their tracks already. But so with this sort of incredibly political background, it's pretty fascinating that this week there's been a new longitudinal study published that's decades in the making, showing that there is no link between fluoride in the water and cognitive issues, sort of like a decline in IQ seems to be what all the proponents arguing against fluoride say, that there's a decline in IQ when fluoride's in the water. So there's no link between fluoride in the water and a decline in cognitive issues. So this is the largest study of its kind and worth going into. But before we do, let me give you a little bit of a lowdown on fluoridation, as it's called.
Yeah.
Adding fluoride to water. So the US government began adding fluoride to water in 1945. So it's not like it's been a recent thing. It's been quite a long public health initiative. And then Australia adopted it in 1953. So we came on board a couple of years later. And today, fluoridation occurs in about 70% of Australian drinking water. So it's not everywhere, but it's in a solid amount.
Yeah.
And so why was it added? Well, there's overwhelming scientific evidence showing that fluoride in drinking water lowers the risk of tooth decay in children and adults. Mm. So stops cavities, stops tooth decay. And in fact, putting fluoride in drinking water, it's so effective that the US Center for Disease Control has previously recognized it as one of the 10 great public health interventions of the 20th century. So this is a big one. And to understand the mechanism of how it works, remember back to your tooth decay education days. I don't know whether you ever, maybe when you first went to the dentist.
Yeah.
So tooth decay happens when bacteria in your mouth eat sugar and make acid. That acid dissolves your tooth enamel,
faster than your saliva can repair it, and that's how cavities are formed. So fluoride just tips the balance back. So when there's a little bit of fluoride in your saliva, it helps your enamel repair itself faster. It forms a tougher, more acid-resistant coating on your teeth, and it slows down how quick cavities can develop. So it literally like remineralizes your teeth, which makes sense given fluoride is a naturally occurring mineral, yeah. Right?
Makes perfect sense.
Makes perfect sense. So that's why fluoride, it's been a very simple and effective public health tool. It's cheap, it's passive, it reaches every demographic. So it's equitable in all senses of the word as well. But despite all this evidence for improved health outcomes in children, in adults, the safety of fluoride has been debated for almost 80 years. So recently there's been an argument against fluoride that's focused on a couple of small studies that have linked fluoride exposure to lower IQ levels in children. But yeah, much of the research focuses on extremely high levels of fluoride, so much higher than the Australian and the American standard levels that you see in water fluoridation, so really high levels of toxicity. And just to bring in a dental research professor for a moment here, Professor Lochdo from the University of Queensland, he was asked about this week, about these studies, and commented that most of the studies that were conducted, they didn't control for other factors. For example, some of the places were really naturally high in fluoride levels already, or they had heavy metal contaminants in their water supply, so they didn't adjust for the fact that there was heavy metal contaminants. No larger studies have been able to replicate the link between low IQ and fluoride.
I mean, it's an interesting angle to be coming from, though. Is like, so what are you saying about the people of Utah, RFK? You know, you're suggesting that the entire state has got a lower IQ than it should, and blaming fluoride for it? Is that basically what he's saying? You know,
I mean. I could not guess what he is saying at any one time, Stu. I cannot guess.
It may be the brainworm speaking.
Yeah, indeed. But anyway, this is where we come to with the new research. So it's a major research. It's decades long. It was led by a researcher named John Robert Warren. And this research group followed 26,820 people, like young people, from 1,020 high schools. And as the researchers say, this was a representative sample across the US. So this is, this is representative of high schools and demographics and people all over the country. And then participants were tracked throughout the study between 1980 and 2021. So they're now around 60 years old. So this, well, when it was 2021, they were around 60 years old, and that's when the study sort of completed. And the researchers compared cognitive testing results when they were adolescents, so reading comprehension, mathematics, vocab, and then they followed up with a subset of the cohort across the 40 years, a representative subset. And they compared the cognitive testing with the local fluoridation practices. So what the area that they lived in, how they fluoridated their water, and they looked at the actual fluoride levels in drinking water, and they also looked at data from geological surveys to get a sense of naturally occurring fluoride as well, to sort of like see how the fluoridation affected their whether there was any effect on their IQ. And what they found was there was no evidence that exposure to the recommended fluoride levels, so that's 0.7 milligrams per litre, impaired childhood cognition. There was no evidence of fluoride causing cognitive decline later in adulthood. In fact, interesting, there was slightly better cognition scores in early life, for those with fluoride in the water, but the effect was pretty small and it disappeared as people aged, so there didn't seem to be any long-term difference either way. But pretty much, like, this seems to be, like, the best evidence that community-level fluoride exposure does not harm the brain. And, you know, why having reliable, solid evidence matters so much for our public health. Because, you know, dental disease, it's widespread, and going to the dentist costs a lot of money, and that's not getting cheaper anytime soon. So anything low cost and clever and safe and reliable that we can do, we should be doing.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things I find interesting too is that a lot of the anti-fluoridation people will say, well, lots of European countries don't put fluoride in their water and lots of other countries don't put fluoride in their water. But there's a lot of countries who do other things. Like there's countries who put fluoride in salt, for example. There's countries who put fluoride in milk. And they're getting the benefits of fluoridation, just not in the drinking water because they're finding it easier to put it in other products. And the other thing that I've noticed too is that people point and say, well, lots of countries in Europe don't have fluoridation in their water supplies, but the countries that don't have terrible dental health. So you're right. There are countries in Europe who don't have fluoridation and they don't get the benefit from it, which is that you get better teeth.
And that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And that's it for another episode of Lost in Science. Lost in Science is recorded for 3CR in Melbourne on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. And it airs across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We would love you to get in touch with us. You can email us at lostinsci@gmail.com or you can find us on Facebook, we're Lost in Science on 3CR, or on Twitter, where we're at lostinscience1. You can find us on your favourite podcast app, where if you get the chance, please give us a good rating and review, as that will raise us up in the search rankings so other people can find the science. Or you can listen to us however you listen to us now, where at the same time every week, Claire, Stu and Chris get
Lost in Science!
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.